Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 9th of December, a day when many of you all over Wisconsin are listening to us at home today because your place of business or your school is not functioning. So we are talking to you from downtown Milwaukee, where we have wet snow. We don't have nothing approaching 17 inches of snow, maybe three or so snowing now, and will continue to snow during the course of the day, and then that really cold weather will come in, but I can only imagine what it must be like to have over 17 inches of snow. We think that one of our guests from the University of Michigan couldn't make it into work today because we can't locate him, but we do have our second half hour guest who will join us for the full hour. Professor Jennifer Victor will be joining us momentarily, assistant professor of political science at the University of Pittsburgh. Thanks to John Munson for filling in for me today. We have furlough days, as you know, being state employees, so I was furloughed. I had my cholesterol tested. What a way to spend your furlough day. It was a lot of fun. No, it was okay. It's necessary, so it was okay. We, this hour of the program, are going to be talking. Can you believe it's almost been a whole year since President Obama has been in office? And he has about a 50% approval rating. President George Bush had an 86% approval rating after his first year in office. President Clinton, 53%. Bush Sr. had a 71%. President Reagan, a 49%. President Carter, 57%. And President Nixon, 59%. We'll be looking at criticism that he has received for having too many things going on. I don't know how these people carry on with the kind of schedule that they have. He was on Capitol Hill on Sunday of this week, lobbying Democratic senators to get together on a health care bill. And there is word last night that the Democrats did get together on a health care bill. We just don't know what it is yet. He was talking yesterday about his agenda for creating jobs for the huge number of Americans who are out of work. The climate change conference is taking place in Copenhagen, and he will be heading to Copenhagen to deal with climate change on a world level with many other leaders in the world. So is it too much, or is this normal? Does he need to really center in on one issue and see it to completion, see some kind of success? How important is success now? Also, Afghanistan, he talked last week, major address about Afghanistan. And how the American public feels about these issues varies. They really do want some kind of health care reform. There is a great deal of questioning about the strategy in Afghanistan and whether or not it will work. And there is growing controversy about climate change. And so all of that is, and the jobs, I forgot the jobs. That's a huge issue in this country. We'll be welcoming phone calls for our guest. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The second hour, let me grab his book here. The second hour of our program, you have recommended him so often. Greg Mortensen is going to be with us, author of Three Cups of Tea, and he now has a new book just released, Stones into Schools, Promoting Peace with Books, Not Bombs, in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. Three Cups of Tea was on the New York Times bestseller list for many, many, many months, years actually. Greg is the co-founder of the nonprofit Central Asia Institute and a founder of Pennies for Peace. He has received Pakistan's highest civil award for his dedicated and humanitarian effort to promote education and literacy in rural areas in Afghanistan and Pakistan for 15 years. So he will be with us the second hour of our program to talk about his latest all-important work. We welcome your phone calls, 800-486-8655. For you to join our conversation, what do you think of the job the president has been doing? Does he have too many balls in the air? Where would you like to see his major concentration? And what kind of approval rating would you give him as he enters his 11th month in office? Professor Jennifer Victor, assistant professor of political science at the University of Pittsburgh, is with us. Hello, Professor Victor.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, how is it in Pittsburgh?
Actually, it's lovely here this morning. It's in the high 30s and sunny at the moment.
You've got to be kidding me.
They've been warning us all day that the storm is coming, but it's not here now.
Oh, did you? Madison has 17.5 inches of snow closed down. They never closed down the university system. Closed.
I know it.
Yeah, it's quite something. So we'll imagine you in Pittsburgh, 37 and sunny. And thank you so much. We can't find our other guest. We assume that he's having a hard time getting into work on this very snowy day. Does it make sense for us to look at what the overall approval ratings are for our president as he enters his 11th month, almost a year, or should we give him more time?
Well, I guess it depends on what exactly you want to try to glean. Often people look at approval ratings to try to get a sense of what might happen in the next election, either the midterm election or the next presidential election, or to get a sense of what's to come. At this point, I think we're too far out from either election for Obama's approval ratings to be particularly predictive or indicative of what might happen in any future election. So I think it's hard to say, except that it's a snapshot of where things are right now.
And he's about 50%. We poll so much now that day to day we get a different poll. Sometimes it's dipped down to 49% in the last week. Is 50% okay for him?
What do you mean okay for him?
Is it okay, or is that a good number, or is that a bad number, or is it obviously it's kind of a middling number here.
Well, I'm not sure that 50% in and of itself, except that we have some psychological attachment to it, I don't know that it, in and of itself it's particularly indicative of anything significant. He is at his lowest approval rating. The numbers that have been coming out this week are the lowest that he's had at this point in his presidency. So I guess it's meaningful in that sense. And as you mentioned in your introduction, at this stage in his presidency, he does have a lower number than other previous presidents in the modern era have had at this same, 11 months in point. However, I'm not sure that these numbers mean anything other than people are concerned about the economy.
Mm-hmm. And the economy is a tough one, right? Yesterday, he has all these huge, major speeches. Afghanistan, huge. The economy. Going to Copenhagen, climate change, one of the biggest issues on the face of the earth right now. Huge issues. But the economy, it seems to me, is something where he needs to center. And he would like to see some success. But my understanding is that's where the success is going to be very hard to win.
Well, and presidents, as much as we like to either ascribe blame or credit to presidents for the economy as voters, that's typically how we operate. Presidents have some control, but definitely not ultimate control over what happens in the economy. Presidents can play a hand in fiscal policy, raising and lowering of taxes and spending and so forth, and may have some very minor influence over monetary policy set by the Fed, but the Fed operates relatively independently. So it's hard to say how much actual control, either in terms of credit or blame, that we can put on the president's shoulders.
Mm-hmm. What about creating jobs? A second stimulus for jobs.
Right. Well, and often when an economy goes into a recession, jobs are sort of the last thing to recover. It takes a long time to create jobs. And even if the Democrats are successful at creating a second stimulus here over the next couple of months, which is politically what they need to do, and are successful at passing some large bill that's aimed at increasing the number of jobs and some kind of job stimulus, it would definitely be slow. I heard one analyst suggest that if they were able to pass a $200 billion bill that would create 5 million new jobs, that it might reduce unemployment by around 3%, that it might take us from, let's say, 10% down to, say, 7%. Now, to a lot of people, 7% unemployment still is on the high side. Percentage-wise, that would be a significant dip, but still relatively high unemployment. So it's hard to make a dent. It takes a long time.
Mm-hmm. Healthcare reform. The Senate has evidently reached some kind of agreement. They're crunching the numbers right now to see how much it would cost. We've been talking about healthcare for a long time here. Is it a crucial thing for the president to have some kind of bill, preferably by Christmas?
Well, I don't know that he'll get a bill on his desk before Christmas. It seems perhaps increasingly likely that the Senate may pass something before Christmas. But, of course, then the House and Senate have passed different bills. I heard one late suggestion yesterday that the Democrats in the House are considering not having a conference on the health care bill, which would suggest that the House may consider the Senate's version of the bill. I don't know if that's a serious proposal or if that's just something that's being talked about. In any case, whether the House considers the Senate bill or they actually have a conference, we're still several weeks away from Congress being able to get a bill actually to the president, I think.
So what do you mean by that? The House would just say okay to the Senate bill?
The House has once the two chambers have adopted different versions of the bill, they have the option of one chamber deciding to simply adopt the other chamber's bill, which is one of the ways the two chambers can reconcile the differences between the bill. Because it can't go to the president's desk until both chambers of Congress have passed and voted on exactly the same version of the bill.
Are you getting more information than I am about what's in this bill?
In the Senate version?
Yes.
No, they're pretty tight-lipped about it. The suggestion this morning seems to be that there's been a compromise. So Harry Reid set up this group of five liberal Democrats and five moderate Democrats to try to come up with some kind of compromise. And the suggestion seems to be that they've taken the public option off the table. The spin that they're putting on it is that it's an expansion of perhaps both Medicare and the Office of Personnel Management, which is the office that runs the healthcare system for government employees, specifically members of Congress, and that there might be developing an option for the public to buy into the health systems that are managed by the OPM or the Office of Personnel Management for the government.
And I've been hearing numbers 55 to 64 might be able to take advantage of Medicare. Would younger people then be able to take advantage of that federal employees' health care system?
That's unclear. I don't think we're going to know. Harry Reid has suggested that they're going to be rather tight-lipped about this new proposal that they've creatively divined until they've gotten an estimate on how much it's going to cost from the Congressional Budget Office. So depending on how long it takes the CBO to score this bill, we may not know very much about it for a couple of days.
And what about the public, Professor Victor, on this? I don't know if we ought to look at polls on this. They seem to have been all over the place, whether or not we want a public option, whether we don't want a public option. What about whether or not we want health care reform?
The public seems to be relatively favorable on health care reform. I don't have any current numbers in front of me, but over time, those numbers in favor of some version of healthcare reform seem to be tricking up. There's a lot of mixed information about what a public option is and what it means, and so I think the numbers for that have been somewhat predictably all over the place because it's getting interpreted in different ways, and Congress itself seems to be sending mixed signals about what they mean by offering a public option. So those numbers are all over the place because nobody knows how to interpret it. But the idea of some kind of health care reform, there seems to be relatively strong support from that. And even Republicans who tend to be against the proposals that Democrats have put forward say that they're in favor of health care reform. There seems to be this general national imperative and a great amount of consensus on things like not being able to drop people for pre-existing conditions and things of that nature. How all of that translates into something that Congress passes that the president might sign is at this point still a little bit unclear.
Right. You would expect to have this happen, but it seems as though having five progressive senators, five moderate senators who, my understanding is, have wildly different ideas about what kind of health reform we have, to get them together for what was a relatively short period of time and jump to an agreement makes you wonder. It seemed fairly easy. I don't know what they came up with, but you would have thought that would have been a long struggle.
Well, it's not totally clear to me how long they've been working on this. There's some suggestion that is when the Finance Committee, the Senate Finance Committee, finished their version of the bill that they passed in committee. That in October or November now? I'm not remembering, that, you know, Olympia Snow, who sits on that committee, a Republican from Maine, voted in favor. She's the only Republican that voted in favor of that bill. At that point, there seemed to be some inkling that there is the beginning of negotiations as the Senate began to try to combine the different versions of bills that they had passed in committee. And, you know, this is it's a deliberative process, and the Senate is often known as the world's great deliberative body. So the idea that they just sort of a couple of days ago got a small group together and hammered this out is probably not quite the accurate picture.
Mm-hmm. Let's welcome phone calls for you. We have yet to talk about Afghanistan and to find out what the public thinks about the president's announced strategy. Time goes so fast. Was it last week that he did that? So many other speeches have been given since then. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The president in his 11th month in office, approval ratings about 50%. Some saying he's just taking on too many large issues and he needs to focus on one and let the people in America know exactly what direction he wants to take us and then move there. Or is it such a time, as many presidents have had to deal with all kinds of important issues? What do you think? His poll numbers on Afghanistan are not very strong. We can talk about that. Some healthcare reform, are you hopeful? And is that an issue that you really want to see something done about before Christmas or shortly thereafter? Jobs, what you thought of his plan, announced plan to create jobs in this country. How overall the president is doing, kind of a report card. Our number, 800-486-8655 is our number. And I know that some of you, actually a lot of you, this storm hit Wisconsin. I think we were the only place. We're seeing Kenosha as well, but people along the lake, the southern part of the state, just because of the warmth of the lake, it's not going to be warm much longer, just didn't get the kind of snow that you did. It's coming down pretty steadily now, but so I'm thinking about you who are in your winter wonderlands today with 17 and a half inches of snow. So call us. Lines are open. And our guest this hour is Professor Jennifer Victor, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Pittsburgh. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, he has been much requested and has finally, and this is a good thing, received a great deal of international acclaim and attention. Greg Mortensen is going to be with us. His book, Stones into Schools. He's the one who wrote Three Cups of Tea. This one is promoting peace with books, not bombs, in Afghanistan and Pakistan. He will be with us. He's doing a book tour now and has done just remarkable things in Afghanistan and Pakistan, building schools. And the stories he has to tell, he says the stories are the fire within him, what keeps him going. And some of the stories are absolutely extraordinary. So he will be with us, hour number two. This hour of the show, Professor Jennifer Victor, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Pittsburgh, and we're talking about the president's 11 months in office, what's on the table, what his approval ratings are, comparing his ratings to other presidents, and talking about how meaningful they may be or may not be. Does he need a victory here in some area in healthcare? Afghanistan is not going to be a quick victory. And we also have the question of what does victory in Afghanistan mean? Will jobs front and climate change? There's a lot that's on the table. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. I want you to comment before we go to phone calls, which are coming in, Professor Victor, on Afghanistan, the approval ratings for his policy here, how he has handled Afghanistan, and we have yet to see how the new strategy will work, have not been great for the president. We've about had it there, haven't we?
Well, it's certainly been a tough issue for the president, for America, really, in general. And he, I think, has the good fortune to have very strong military advisors. General McChrystal was the general who was in charge of the team that captured Saddam Hussein back in 2005, was it? And he seems to be now coalescing very nicely with what his military advisors want. But he is receiving a lot of mixed reaction. It seems to me that the approach that he laid out in his speech that they're going forward with was a little bit of an appeasement to both sides. For the war hawks, he was giving General McChrystal and the other military advisors who wanted it to escalate presence in Afghanistan more or less what they asked for, maybe a few thousand troops less than what they ideally wanted, but certainly the commitment they were looking for. And to appease the liberals, he has put this strict timetable on, which means the liberals are, of course, upset about the escalation and the conservatives are upset about the timetable. So Obama seems to be pursuing this strategy of middle-of-the-road appeasement, which if you look at all of the various political issues that he's tackled so far, whether it's the economy or healthcare, climate change and Afghanistan has been his four major issues so far. This seems to be his MO, is this big tent philosophy about operating in government and trying to bring all sides together. So it remains to be seen exactly how successful that approach will be.
Mm-hmm. And how long will we give him when it comes to Afghanistan?
Well, when it comes to Afghanistan specifically, I'm not sure. You know, so the next big public test, of course, will be the midterm congressional elections. And the conventional wisdom there is that the party of the president always loses seats in the Congress during a midterm election. The modern exceptions to that were Clinton in 98 and George W. Bush in 2002, who both gained seats in their midterm elections those years. They both at the time also had approval ratings that were upwards of 60%. Other than those exceptions, though, the party of the president almost always lose seats. So it's a pretty safe bet to say that the Democrats will probably lose seats in the congressional midterm next year. But remember that the Democrats have a 78-seat advantage in the House right now. So they would have to lose 39 seats in order for it to actually flip to Republican majority, and that seems pretty unlikely. So what we're going to be looking at is the approval rating of President Obama as we get closer to November, which I think would have to really be quite low in order to precipitate an actual majority shift in the Congress.
Well, not that the Democrats have anything to write home about, but the Republican approval ratings are dismal.
That's true. The Republican Party is really, I think we call this a rebuilding era. You know, the George W. Bush's approval ratings were really very low when he left office, and the party has been sort of struggling to piece itself back together since then. And I have no doubt that they will. They still seem to be coming together and trying to coalesce on a central strategy. It's not quite clear what the central message of the party is, except to be, you know, the parties are in the business of winning elections, right? And the Republican Party, their job right now is to be the opposition party, and so they are going to oppose whatever it is that the Democrats put forward. And so we can certainly expect to see more of that from the Republican Party for now.
Let's get a phone call. Scott from La Crosse, our first caller. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen. Hello, guest. Another great program, Kathleen. I really, really love your work.
Thank you.
My question is about this compromise and what I have heard and mentioned, I guess maybe this morning on public radio, is that if the doctors now and the medical community, the hospitals, are not really thrilled to have Medicare expanded because they get a lower rate of reimbursement on those for those folks. But on the other hand, it seems to me that it's a temporary measure. Is that not right? And that it's only until the full bill goes into effect. I heard something about 2014, and I guess my question is: will those folks stray off the path with the president now, or are they going to swallow hard and say, "Okay, well, in the long run, this is going to give us what we really want"?
Is that question to me?
Yeah, please. Sorry,
well,
no, it was just me rambling on, actually.
We really are operating on very little information about this compromise bill that's coming out of the Senate. they're being pretty tight-lipped about it, and so we're not going to know for several days until we get the CBO score on the bill as to what exactly is in it. But there are many senators, both Democrats and moderate Republicans, who are on the record of saying that they are against a Medicare expansion. So Senator Mary Landrieu, conservative Democrat of Louisiana, Olympia Snow, Republican of Maine, Kent Conrad of North Dakota, all of these senators who are really key votes for this bill have said that they're not in favor of a Medicare or a Medicaid expansion. So I'm not sure what that means. Harry Reid, in the quotes that I heard from him, seemed very optimistic that the compromise was a way to move the bill forward. But frankly, from what I've seen of it, or the hints that they've put out, the leaks that have come out so far, I don't quite see how they get to 60.
Yeah, I was thinking that maybe the temporary would get everybody to, you know, to kind of go along with it. That's what I heard. Now I don't know how accurate that is, but I thought I heard that it would be only until 2014. It would be a temporary expansion just to get folks covered. But I don't. Who knows? I guess.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. And the reporting that I read didn't mention that aspect, so I'm not positive.
Okay, great. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott. When are we going to get more information on this? How long does it take for the budget office to look at these numbers? Do you think by tomorrow or later in this week?
I think by later in the week. I'm sure that it's their highest priority right now, and the whole staff over there is doing whatever they need to do to crunch the numbers to come up with the score on this bill. And they're getting a lot of pressure to do so, but it's obviously, depending on how much detail the Congressional Budget Office has received from the legislators about the context of the bill, may depend on how accurate the score is and how quickly they can produce it. But typically, even when it's a high priority, it takes them a few days.
George from Milwaukee, hi.
Yeah, hi. A couple things. I think that the poll numbers at this time were predictable. I think that Americans don't respond when the economy continues to be bad. I think that was inevitable. I think Obama admitted it was going to take a long time to move it around. There seems to be some indications that it's happening now. I think also the unpopular wars that he inherited was, you know, everybody knew that those things were not going to be over by this time. People are still upset about it. People who are on the left of the Democratic Party are upset because they think Obama's been too moderate, so some of the poll numbers probably show dissatisfaction from those people as well. And I also disagree with the notion that he can't, you know, walk and chew gum at the same time. There's a lot of things on the agenda that are important that be taken care of as soon as possible, whether it's climate change legislation, the economy, a bigger stimulus package, working on health reform. So a lot of there's a lot of pent-up energy that was there for 8 years under Bush when so many things didn't get dealt with. So I think that you're going to see, even if it's a very moderate health plan that emerges and there seems to be some uptick in the economy, I don't think that he's in that much trouble yet.
I completely agree with George. I think that's an accurate analysis. Presidential approval ratings correlate almost perfectly with the state of the economy, the general state of the economy. And if you look at just the relationship between the unemployment rate and presidential approval ratings, they track each other nearly perfectly. So I think George from Milwaukee is absolutely right that it's predictable that Obama's numbers would be low at this time because as the unemployment rate has gone up, his approval ratings have gone down. And economists are suggesting that the unemployment rate may stay high for a while, even though we had this recent small downtick, that they may still continue to go up into 2010, which means we should expect Obama's approval ratings to continue to decline until those unemployment numbers begin to turn around. So the approval ratings is all about the economy, economy, economy.
Right. I was wondering last night, I was watching the news, NBC I think it was, and they were talking about TARP money that was never spent. And I was thinking, why wasn't some TARP money spent, and where the heck is it? Do you know?
Right. Well, when the $700 billion-some-odd money was passed for TARP, the purpose of the money was essentially to save the banks, to bail out the banks that were getting ready to go under. And it was one of a few techniques that the government used to prevent the economy from collapsing into an abyss, which all evidence points to exactly that was about to happen, and that the efforts that the government took at the end of 2008 and beginning of 2009 with respect to TARP and stimulus and mortgage rates and so forth all helped to prevent that collapse. Now, when TARP was set up, banks were able to essentially apply to receive TARP funds if they met certain criteria, and the government made enough money available to save as many banks as they thought was necessary. So the fact that some money is left over simply means that perhaps we estimated that more banks would need that money than actually came true. You know, it all happened so quickly, and there were so many estimates that were done. It's not surprising to me that there was a decent amount of error in those estimates. The suggestion that Obama made yesterday in his speech at the Brookings Institution was that we might be able to use some of those TARP funds to help with job stimulus. And there's a little bit of, legal wrangling there. If you're actually going to use the funds that the Congress approved for TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, legally they can only be used for something that has to do with what TARP was set up for. So, for example, President Obama suggested that they might use it to help extend loans in a beneficial way to small businesses, was a major theme that he talked about yesterday. And so loans through banks to small businesses would be something that would be consistent with TARP. But other forms of job stimulus in the form of whether it was welfare transfer payments or job creation programs or direct tax stimulus or any other form would have to be approved by Congress. They couldn't just take the TARP funds and turn them into something that was not initially TARP related.
Well, that's interesting, because I've heard that a lot of those banks did some very questionable things with that money, that they had these golf outings, that they were underwriting questionable lending practices to poor people. I mean, it's a whole area that hasn't been as reported probably as it ought to have been.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll get more details about that as it comes out. And there is an independent oversight committee that is looking over this. And so as more and more of that data and information gets collected, I'm sure we'll learn more about exactly how that money was used. The reporting that I have read has suggested that about 10% of the TARP funds may have been used in a way that was non-productive, which I think doesn't mean that all of it was used inappropriately, but at least some portion of it may have been. Which, another way to say that is that 90% of the TARP funds were used in a way that was exactly how they were intended. Of course, the reporting, the stuff that will get attention is the stuff that points to the bad apples. But I think, in general, the TARP sort of emergency rescue program did exactly what it was supposed to do.
Thanks, George, for your call. Laverne is next from Monroe. Hi, Laverne.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi,
Hello,
Laverne.
Jennifer.
Good morning.
Great program.
Thanks.
I think President Obama is trying to do too many things at one time, too. I think the problem is the economy. 130 commercial banks went broke, and while there's five big banks too big to fail, and they bail them out, I think the problem is Ben Bernanke. I think he's going to keep favoring the big banks. And I think Obama said he was going to tax the rich. And I think the reason he hasn't been really going after them is because of campaign finance reform, mainly the 527s. These are the guys that give these politicians money so they keep taxing the middle class.
Well, let's see. You hit on a lot of things there. First, with respect to the president being distracted or trying to do too many things at once, I don't really think there's a lot of evidence for that. You might remember this was an issue briefly during the campaign, just before the first debate between Barack Obama and John McCain. It was at the beginning of the financial crisis back last fall 2008, and McCain made this emergency suspension to his campaign in a way that grabbed headlines and immediately flew back to Washington to help with the crisis. and suggested that they might suspend the first debate, at which point Obama made a point of saying the president has to be able to multitask and walk and chew gum at the same time, and of course we should have the debate, and of course we can pay attention to the financial crisis at the same time. And it seemed to me that Obama won that little media political wrangling over that issue. The government is huge, and the president is in charge of it, of course, but the number of employees and staff that work on multiple issues simultaneously has really few bounds. So I'm not sure that we can look at his approval ratings and suggest that it means that Obama is trying to do too many things at once. It really, to me, it's all about the state of the economy. That's what presidential approval ratings, regardless of Obama or any president, that's what they're almost always about. With regard to tax cuts and campaign finance and so forth, this has been a partisan issue for a long time. Republican presidents have a tendency, at least in the modern era since Ronald Reagan, have tended to cut taxes for the wealthy. And Democratic presidents have tended to raise taxes for the wealthy and expand the tax base. So I imagine we will see exactly more of the same here. The tax cuts that were put into place under the Bush administration in 2001 and 2003 that were known as EGTRA and JEGTRA were set to expire in 2010. So, and many of those are tax cuts that went to the wealthy. So the choice that the Congress and the president is put under is to whether to let those tax cuts expire, which during the campaign is what they said that they wanted to do. But, of course, that essentially means increasing taxes on those Americans. And the Republicans will, of course, paint it as a tax increase, because essentially it will be. The alternative is to find some other way to either raise revenue or cut spending, both of which are highly unpopular.
Professor Jennifer Victor is our guest this hour. She is assistant professor of political science at the University of Pittsburgh. We're talking about all that the president has on his plate right now, whether or not it's too much, looking at his poll number of overall approval rating, which is about 50%, comparing it to other presidents after 11 months in office, and looking at the major issues and the disparity among those issues in terms of whether or not we approve of his approach on Afghanistan, on healthcare, on the economy. We will have one line open. 800-486-8655 is the number, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Wednesday, Greg Mortensen will be joining us. His latest book is Stones into Schools, Promoting Peace with Books, Not Bombs, in Afghanistan and Pakistan. It traces the efforts of his Central Asia Institute to build schools in a whole new country, the northeast corner of Afghanistan, a place that proved even more challenging to work in than Pakistan. It is part of his approach, the last best place philosophy, in which he starts schools in the most isolated valleys where they are needed most, and then works back toward more populated areas. He will be with us, hour number two. Our guest this hour is Professor Jennifer Victor, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Pittsburgh, and we're welcoming your phone calls. We go to Barbara from Madison. Hi, Barbara. I must ask you how the snow is, because caller.
I just feel so happy to have public radio for my companion.
All right.
Every day, not only today, because I'm an 84-year-old person, and so I lived in the last Depression, and I know of the loss of one's property, and I've been, first of all, I'm going to say I was thrilled that a man of color was elected to be our president in my lifetime. It thrilled me beyond my ability to describe it, but I think he has many issues that he has to face, but I've been a little bit troubled that he hasn't given regard to people who are losing their homes, and that money went to Wall Street, but did it come to the banks, the local banks and local businesses, who really can stimulate the economy, the local economy, all over the country? And this has been troubling to me.
Professor?
Yeah, I think you, in a lot of ways, Barbara, have hit the nail on the head. The president in his speeches has talked a lot about wanting to help smaller banks and smaller businesses. That's a lot of what he talked about in his speech yesterday at the Brookings Institution, and using investment in small business as a way to fuel economic recovery and job creation. Of course, it's a more difficult thing to do, and politically, it's more challenging to fuel resources to those smaller businesses than it is to the larger banks. And I think that our representatives of both parties, really, but mostly the Democrats, because they're in charge now, are going to come under some fire for at least the appearance that the big banks, big business, more informed, more affluent and capable institutions have received more of the government help, whether it's through the TARP program or any of the other stimulus packages that we've seen so far. So I think you're right to recognize it and to criticize it. I think that the Obama administration will come under, and already has, but may come under more attack for paying more attention to Wall Street or the more well-represented interests, as some people think of them. On the other hand, I think the Democrats are trying to speak to this issue and at least paying attention to the idea that we could use a lot of stimulus in the area of small business, and they're going to make some attempts to funnel money that way. We'll just have to wait and see what happens with it.
Anything else, Barbara? Thank you very much for the call. Well, also, a lot of this gets thrown in our face, and it may be a small part of this, but to those of us who are working every day and making a small amount of money, to see these people now benefiting from the TARP money that they received and probably buying their 15th house and back to their huge bonuses, et cetera. It doesn't jive.
Yeah, it doesn't sit right with a lot of people. I think that's exactly right.
Yeah. All right, let's go next to Dave is joining us from Menominee. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Thank you. Your guest had said something that made me grab the phone, which was the approval rating and how it court goes along with the economy, how the economy is going. Almost exact. Now, look, if we engineer this from backwards, if I wanted, while a Democrat is in office, knowing that a Democrat was probably going to get elected, they probably knew that many months before the election, so they were, getting themselves ready to, you bring the interest rate down to where, you can't do anything, and you get put in this position to where, let's see if they can solve this. And while the new administration is in trying to solve it, you try to do anything they can to make sure they can't solve it. Because if the economy is crappy, well, his ratings will be crappy, and of course that's what we want. As Republicans, if I were, that's what I would want if I was a hard nose and didn't really care, what the results were outside of Washington. And that's what it seems like to me. I mean, we had a zero interest rate. We couldn't even lower the interest rates. It was perfectly set up to where you had to be extremely intelligent to try and solve this problem. And while they're trying to solve it, we try to make sure they can't solve it. And that's the way it seems to me. And I wanted to get your guest's thoughts on that.
All right, Dave.
Yeah, so the idea that perhaps the Republicans could have engineered an economic sabotage in order to put the Democrats in an unreconcilable, unsolvable pickle, it's probably a bit on the extreme. I certainly see the logic, and to your credit, there is some evidence that political actors will sometimes manipulate or attempt to manipulate things like interest rates or aspects of fiscal policy to try to get the natural economic cycle moving in a way that is to their benefit. For example, Reagan in the early 80s, the suggestion was that recession that we had in the early 80s was timed just right so that the economy would be back on the upswing during the 84 election. And there's some evidence to support that. However, conspiracy theory aside and the idea of economic sabotage aside, I think there's a couple of points of evidence to suggest that that's probably not entirely what happened. First is the idea that the economy crashed before the election. The economy was on its way down and already crashing, in fact, well before the election, early in 2008, when the Bush administration had that you know, they had that stimulus package early in the year where they sent out stimulus checks to lots of Americans who unfortunately decided to save them instead of spend them, which is why that stimulus didn't work. But if the Republican Party was in the business of trying to manipulate the economy in a way that was politically advantageous to them, then surely they would have done so to prevent the incredible economic collapse that most certainly led to the huge Democratic sweep in the 08 election. So the fact that the crash happened well before the election gives me some pause there. The other piece of evidence that gives me some pause is that as we were speaking about earlier, political actors certainly have some control and influence over the economy, but they're not the puppet masters. The economy has a natural business cycle to it. There will always be downturns. There will always be upswings. We can use our fiscal and monetary tools to some extent to help soften the downturns and help try to extend the upswings. But in a lot of ways, many of those things, because we live in a laissez-faire, essentially a fundamentally laissez-faire system, a lot of those things are essentially out of our control. And the economic crash that occurred late in 2008 and continued into early 2009 was a combination of both the down point of the business cycle and the mortgage crisis, the troubled assets. It was sort of the perfect storm of a combination of things that led the economy to this natural abyss. If we thought the Republicans wanted to sabotage the Democrats, then it seems to me it would have been much smarter of them to have prevented that near collapse in the first place, and then perhaps they could have prevented the huge sweep in the 08 election.
Thanks, Dave. Jim from Milwaukee is our next caller. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. I don't know who to be more disgusted with on Afghanistan, the public or the Obama's con manipulations or the conservatives' con manipulations. The public ignores the cost of the war. The public ignores the Muslim point of view, which you could get out of John Perkins' Confession of an Economic Hitman. Or you could go to the net under Manifest Destiny Racism and find a history of American behavior in this regard. The whole attitude is that the Afghans are barbarians. They can't handle their business. But we miraculously can get them back to handling their business, and we can do it by July of 2011. And yet this week, Gates and Karzai are already undercutting that. And that's a classic example of a good cop, bad cop manipulation, with Obama being the good cop. And finally, the conservatives say that, well, you know, if we announce a departure date, we can't have this because then we won't be able to succeed. But the real issue is, can the Afghani people handle their own business? And if they can handle their own business, the date that we leave and whether we announce it is irrelevant. So again, the conservatives just come up with a distraction.
Professor Hudson.
Yeah, I think you've hit on a couple of interesting issues there. First, the idea that I'm sensitive to the idea that when the United States or any country really gets involved with some type of either military action or imperialist action in other nations that are in the developing world that don't have economies that are as large or as strong as our own or as the Western world, there's almost always the suggestion of some type of either ethnocentrism or sort of moral superiority or something like that going on. And I don't think that those are unfair criticisms. However, in the case of Afghanistan with the United States, it seems pretty clear to me that since our first engagement in Afghanistan in 2001 and up until today, our primary mission there has been about our own national security. So the initial bombing that we did in 2001, in September of 2001, had to do with response to the 9/11 attacks, and our continued engagement there has been to defeat what the government has told us is the heart of the Al-Qaeda network, which is the network that attacked us on 9/11. of course, there's a whole lot of debate about how well that's been managed and how successful it's been and so forth. But I think the caller is right to raise the question of whether or not our purpose there is about security and our own national security, or whether it's about nation building. And as a military, as a government, and with a military power, the United States has a pretty good track record on being able to fight wars and handling security. We don't have a very good track record on helping to build nations, especially doing it from a militaristic standpoint. So I think there is a fair amount of criticism to be had there. It seems to me that the approach that the Obama administration is taking, at least what President Obama has outlined for now, seems to be one that concentrates on security and tries to provide Afghanistan with enough beginning resources to help at least instigate or be a catalyst for rebuilding of their nation in a way that will be sustainable without outside involvement, which, of course, is a very tall mission to be achieved.
A very tall mission, very tall. Well, we don't have time for another phone call. Professor Victor, thank you so much. I really appreciate your staying with us for the whole hour. It may throw your day off a little bit, but you were terrific. And thank you so much for being with us.
I appreciate it, Kathleen.
Our guest is our Professor Jennifer Victor, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Pittsburgh, talking this hour about the president's poll numbers, where he stands after almost a year in office, and what we think of his various policies when it comes to Afghanistan or climate change or jobs or bailing out Wall Street, you name it. Thanks to her for being with us. And for those of you who have a particular interest in Afghanistan, our next guest does as well and has done some extraordinary work in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Greg Mortensen, who is the author of Three Cups of Tea, has a brand new book, and he will be with us, hour number two, to talk about his work. So don't go away. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to John Treader for answering the many calls in our studios here in downtown Milwaukee, where the snow is barely falling right now, but it may pick up. So we think of you. We were the part of the state least hard hit. So we think of you with over 17 inches of snow in other parts of Wisconsin. News is coming up.